From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Sarah Silverman. We won't even begin to describe her Comedy Central show now. We'll let her do it. Let's just say her character is inappropriate, self-absorbed, clueless, tasteless, and very funny. The Sarah Silverman program begins season two tonight. Now on to Revolting. We talk with British food critic Tom Parker Bowles about his year of eating dangerously. On his worldwide tour, he ate silkworm poo pie, baby eels, and dog. Parker Bowles is the son of Prince Charles' wife, Camilla. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new season of the Sarah Silverman program premieres tonight on Comedy Central. I think it's a really funny show. You might not. Silverman intentionally takes on subjects that are sensitive, controversial, or taboo, like AIDS, religion, abortion, and sexual predators. Because her character is self-centered, oblivious, and crude, the show itself may appear to be clueless and tasteless, but to fans like me, it's really funny satire. Silverman is also co-starring in Jeff Garlin's new movie, I Want Someone to Eat Cheese With. She's hosted award shows on MTV and the Independent Film Channel, and she had a performance film called Jesus is Magic. Here's a scene from tonight's episode of the Sarah Silverman program. After Sarah is awakened by church bells, she angrily marches down to the church and barges into the service, where she tells the minister he shouldn't be waking people up with church bells and that he's out of touch with what people want. As she leaves the church, she's approached by two members of the congregation.
Hi. We just want you to know that we agree. Pastor Crayley has lost touch with all the things that matter.
Thank you. See, I always bond with angry lesbians.
Oh, no, we both have husbands and children.
Oh, were you styled by angry lesbians?
No, we're community activists.
I'm sorry, I'm never up to date with what you're calling yourselves. Community activists, it is.
Would you like to join us and some of our friends? We're just gonna talk. There's gonna be coffee and lemon bars.
All right, now you're coming on to me. Luckily, I'm a sicko for lemon bars, so sign me up.
Later in the episode, Sarah goes to their meeting where, as usual, she doesn't get what it's all about.
As Sarah knows, one of our biggest challenges is getting Pastor Crayley to change his thinking on the issues.
I know, it's like the guy's obsessed with these friggin' bells. I don't think it's very Christ-like to wake someone up first thing in the morning going, bong! It's not Christ-like, it's like Christ.
Those are some really valid concerns, Sarah, and we agree with you wholeheartedly. But what we're focusing on primarily is saving the lives of babies, whatever it takes. Babies are being killed all the time, even as we speak.
I know. Poor Africa. I mean, it's like they took every bad thing that can possibly happen and put it in one continent. Drought, disease, safari.
No, Sarah. Babies are being killed right here in America. Right here in Valley Village.
What?
That's a scene from the Sarah Silverman Show. Sarah Silverman, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
I was doing a Q&A the other day, and somebody had remembered the first interview that you and I did, and they said they really liked it. And I said, well, you got to watch her new show. It's really funny. And then I started trying to describe it, and I started saying things like, well, the first episode of the new season, it's really funny. It's all about abortion. And then in the second episode, she's accused of having a kind of sexual relationship with her dog. And I could see people in the audience just cringing.
Yeah.
And I thought, Sarah, you must have a better way of explaining it than I did. Why don't you tell us your version of what your show is about?
I wish I did have a better way of explaining it. Maybe I would say that it's a show about a woman who is a... an arrogant ignorant.
Yeah, perfect.
Who goes through life very earnestly, but is kind of an a-hole.
Yeah, I think that's a really accurate description. Did you always intend on your new show to be covering subjects that need to be treated really delicately, knowing that you would treat them just the opposite?
I didn't necessarily always know that, but It makes sense in terms of, like, that these are topics that are perfect fodder for this character. They create really good dichotomies. Does that make sense?
Kind of.
Yeah. Well, maybe not, but I think that's what I mean. Just the contrast between the sensitivity of a topic and the insensitivity of a girl whose perception of herself is very different than the perception the audience has of her.
So let's hear a clip from an episode from last season called Not Without My Daughter, in which it's a kiddie beauty pageant episode. And there's this Little Miss Rainbow pageant, and you always wanted to win it. So even now as an adult, you're still auditioning for it, even though you're totally much too old for it. And right before you're disqualified, you're doing your dramatic monologue on stage, hoping to become Little Miss Rainbow. Let's hear it.
November 9th, 1942. Peter found some crackers
Mama says we mustn't chew too loud or the Germans may hear. To think we were once Germans ourselves. Well, Hitler's taken our nationality. And he's taken our humanity. But he's not gonna take our rhythm.
Sarah, stop. Please stop.
Sarah Silverman, did you write this monologue?
It's basically from the diary of Anne Frank.
Wait a minute. Anne Frank didn't say, but Hitler couldn't take away our rhythm. That's not from the Diary of Anne Frank.
Let's say it's inspired from the Diary of Anne Frank, and we use the little poetic license with it, creative license, because then it goes into, of course, a tap routine.
Right. Why did you think that this would? what gave you the idea of borrowing from the Diary of Anne Frank for this audition piece for the pageant?
We wanted something that was inappropriate, you know, and did not go well with a tap routine.
Well, I guess that was it.
Yeah, that presented itself and was kind of the perfect choice, the least tasteful choice.
Now, I want to play a clip from another episode last season, and this episode was called Positively Negative. And in this episode, you have the blahs. So you think it might be AIDS. So you go to a clinic to be tested, and while you're waiting for the results to come back, you become a very righteous AIDS activist, inspiring others with your personal story of how you've dealt with AIDS, even though you haven't even been diagnosed with it. So here you are, sitting around a table after you've broken the news that, you know, that you have AIDS to your sister, your sister's boyfriend, and your two gay neighbors. And your sister, who's played by your real sister, speaks first.
Sarah, you can't be serious.
Can't I? AIDS is real, Laura. It doesn't only exist in award-winning films and TV shows.
So you're sure you're HIV positive?
I will be at 7 when I get my results.
Sarah, you really scared us.
What kind of maniac waltzes into a brunch and eclipses a man's first birthday with the mere possibility of having AIDS?
Jay, I'm sure she didn't mean to.
Laura, it's okay. We all grieve in our own way.
You should make your deviled eggs for Jay's birthday party. That's a great idea.
Good.
Really? You'll do that?
Good. Go on. Live life as if nothing ever happened. It's what I want. But do me a favor. Learn from me. I paid the price for my awareness so that you guys don't have to.
Excuse me for eavesdropping, but I'm a school teacher, and, I'd love to have an extraordinary person like you come speak to my class sometime.
Unfortunately, I don't have the luxury of sometime, but I have now. Take me there.
God, I love that clip. It's so funny. And I love the way you mock like the inspirational cliches surrounding illness, because those cliches just really cheapen how serious illness is and how inspirational some people really are. What do you do to get in the spirit of an episode like this? Do you watch a lot of like bad movies to really get into the spirit?
A lot of it is from being raised by television and movies very much. And I think to me, and I'm going to say the word contrast a lot, but it's that contrast between the cadence of what a touching speech sounds like to the ear and its content. Those words are familiar, you know, not the words, but the tone, you know, in a way we're kind of all dogs. And these tones are familiar to us, you know, as serious or as important or as, you know, sad. And when the words are different, but the tone is the same, I think it's funny personally.
No, I agree. Now, you managed to say the word vagina in just about every episode. And
it's kind of like the mouse in Goodnight Moon, vagina. It's on every page somewhere.
Well, why is that?
I don't know. I honestly don't consciously try to think about, like, what's going to shake things up or cause trouble. But I think that we're drawn towards... As a comedian, anyway, you're kind of drawn towards what's taboo or, you know, what you're not supposed to say. It's actually one of the safer taboo words. You know what I mean? You can say it on TV, and it's silly and embarrassing, kind of, and exposing, and do you know what I mean?
Was it ever embarrassing for you to use that word on stage? Because, I mean, I guess, you know, in some ways, one thing you have to say about the vagina monologues is that, like, after seeing it performed on television and seeing the ads for it in every newspaper, it's become less uncomfortable to say a word we were all brought up to be uncomfortable about saying. Nevertheless, when you started using that word on stage, was it awkward for you?
No, it didn't feel awkward for me, but it's funny because there are things I say on stage that someone may come up to me and say to me off stage on another time, and I'm so much more prudish off stage. It's weird. It's like I almost barely recognize that someone will say something that I've said on stage before to me, and I'm so grossed out, you know, and then I realize it's something I've said, you know, but it's just, Terry, there's a time and a place.
Well, there is, and the stage is a place for, I mean, I know what you're saying, because you could say things on stage and do things on stage you wouldn't want done in real life.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I'm thinking how much easier it is probably to be Jerry Seinfeld when he meets fans in the street than when you do, because what you do is just so, it's just so topsy-turvy and so, like, potentially tasteless sounding, though I think it's like great satire of movie cliches and of people behaving inappropriately. But do people behave inappropriately with you kind of misinterpreting what your show is about?
Yeah, it's a real mixed bag. I have, you know, people that come up to me that I think, wow, I'm so lucky. You know, like my boyfriend Jimmy had a show called The Man Show, and for a long time his fans, you know, he'd walk through a mall or something and get, where are the juggies? Where are the, you know, I mean, it's, you know, it people, but in a way I get the same kind of thing where people aren't getting the irony, or they like my stuff in a literal way that's ugly, you know, instead of like gleaning the kind of absolute power of what I mean, which is usually the opposite of what I say, you know.
Right, exactly.
Not to deconstruct too much, but can't really deconstruct more than that.
My guest is Sarah Silverman. The Sarah Silverman Program starts its new season tonight on Comedy Central. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is comic and actor Sarah Silverman. The new season of the Sarah Silverman Program starts tonight on Comedy Central. Now, your sister Laura plays your sister on the show. Did you always act together as kids?
No. I was the youngest, and I was lucky to be the youngest and kind of be very free and less watched and able to do whatever I wanted. And Laura was the other version of people that become actors, I think. She's very introverted and quiet, and she would, you know, she'd have me perform, you know, but would kind of suppress her own desire to perform. And it wasn't until later in life, whereas I was two and I knew I wanted to be a comedian, you know, and an actor, but she kind of let herself. She was always an artist. She's somebody who is cursed with being brilliant at everything she tries. Any instrument she picked up, she could draw any picture. She could write poems that would knock you to the ground. And I feel sorry for her, because I think a lot of the things she's able to do come so easy for her that it doesn't feel like she's doing anything. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And that acting was the only thing that was maybe challenging for her, and she, of course, is also great at. But for me, it was always one thing, you know. I have so many friends that they still don't know what they want in life. And I realize how lucky I am just to always have wanted to be a comedian and an actress and do this stuff, this funny stuff, you know?
I think most of the episodes end with your character in bed, and before she goes to sleep, she reflects on the day and what she's learned, her lessons learned, and she talks to her dog, Doug, about, you know, what's happened to her that day. So I want to play an example of that, and this is at the end of an episode in which you've tried and failed to become a lesbian, and you're talking to your dog, Doug, about it.
I don't know where to start with this one, Doug. I mean, I've failed at heterosexuality. I failed at homosexuality. I guess I just have to stop thinking that the right person's just gonna come along, you know? I have to be the right person. I have to come along. I'm a memosexual. Yeah. Anyway, good night, Dougie. I hope you die in your sleep tonight. Nah, I'm just kidding. But if it had to be one of us, I hope it's you.
That's a scene from the Sarah Silverman program. Sarah, how did you come up with the idea of talking to your little dog, Doug, at the end of each show?
When we first conceived of the show, we thought it would be one full day that starts when I wake up and ends when I go to sleep. And most of the episodes are that, but we didn't... We decided not to, like, marry ourselves to that because we didn't want to sacrifice a good story or something to some rule, you know, of the show that didn't make it better or worse or anything. It was just kind of a convention that we thought was interesting. So we do almost always end with going to bed with Doug and figuring out what we learned. And, of course, what I learned is never... morally valuable. And it just seemed like a good way to kind of bookend the show and to make it all one complete piece. And it was also, you know, we use my real dog.
Oh, I was wondering about that, really?
Yeah, that's my dog, and his name is actually Duck, D-U-C-K, but in the show it's Doug, which was just a... complete whim that I just thought it was funny that we all had our own names, but, you know, Duck is Doug to protect his anonymity. Made me giggle, but now I'm constantly explaining, and people who have known Duck forever is like, is it Duck or Doug? And then I have to be like, no, I... all right. So, but it's because it's just my dog. He's not some specially trained dog or anything. We try to make it pretty easy for him. So the good nights are perfect. He just lies in bed like he does with me anyway at night. And we shoot him for a second while I talk to him and go, hey, puppy, look over here, you know, and have some good cutaways. And the second episode this season, actually, he's got the A story. So, it was a really fun episode, but I don't think I would want him that heavy in a show again because I really felt like a real scummy showbiz mom or something. Like, you know, just get through this and I'll give you a treat, you know. He's just like, I want to go home.
Your dog is so cute at the end of the show. He sometimes puts his head on your leg, and it's just adorable, and you're telling him all this ridiculous
He just kills
all this ridiculous
me.
Stuff.
Something about his face that looks like he's hearing what you're saying and yet is simultaneously kind of dead inside, which is, I find, compelling and sad.
One of the things you've been doing lately is hosting award shows. You hosted, like, the Video Music Awards on MTV or VH1. I forget which one it's on. You hosted the Independent Spirit of Awards, the Independent Film Awards on the Independent Film Channel. And you're really hysterical. You're hilarious when you do the award shows, but you sometimes say things that really get you into trouble. Like on the Music Video Awards, you said something about Paris Hilton, and she was in the audience, and the camera was a close up on her face as you were talking about her. She looked quite pained. Did you know that the camera was going to be on her?
I didn't. But I'll tell you, I don't think that Paris was upset by my joke. I think what was upsetting, which made my heart sink for her personally, was when I set up the joke and said, you know, Paris Hilton is going to jail in 2 days, the crowd cheered for a minute. You know, like it was just like a solid minute of cheering. And I felt bad for her at that point because I was looking right down at her. And there's a 50-year-old, you know, cameraman in her face. And my heart sank for her because I just thought, wow, this is her example of adults. You know, this is her, like, these are her role models. But I went on with the joke because it's a joke, you know, and I was there to be funny and to talk about all the topics and all the things that were going on in pop culture in the MTV world. And with the VMAs, with this Britney stuff, I did a couple jokes about Britney because I followed Britney. I was put on immediately after her. And then I went on and did a whole bunch of jokes, and they were completely overshadowed by the entree into the monologue, which was, you know, how about that? There was Britney Spears, you know, and a couple jokes about that. I don't think that I said anything different than any late night talk show host has before and after that, but I was first, you know, and I kind of got scapegoated. Surprise, surprise. The Jew is the scapegoat. God forbid she rehearse or whatever. Not stay out till 7 a.m., but I'm the bad guy.
Sarah Silverman will be back in the second half of the show. The Sarah Silverman program starts its second season tonight on Comedy Central. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of their classics edition of The Essential Tales and Poems of Edgar Allan Poe, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Cato Charitable Foundation, supporting the National Parks Conservation Association, whose report on the effects of global warming in national parks can be found at npca.org. And from the Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities, on the web at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, British food critic Tom Parker Bowles tells us about the year he spent traveling the world sampling culinary extremes. It's the subject of his memoir, The Year of Eating Dangerously. He's the son of Camilla Parker Bowles. Also, more with comic Sarah Silverman. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is comic and actress Sarah Silverman. Her Comedy Central show, The Sarah Silverman Program, starts its second season tonight on Comedy Central. Let's get back to our interview. One of the things you're up to now, you're in Jeff Garlin's new movie, I Want Someone to Eat Cheese With.
Yeah.
And he was recently on the show. One of the things he talked about is how earlier in his career, he had like panic attacks, even like on stage. And I know I've read that you had panic attacks when you were young, and it just seems so counterintuitive that somebody who would have panic attacks would want to put themselves in a situation where they'd be in the public eye, because where are you more likely to have a panic attack than when everybody's watching you? So, you know, it seems like quite a paradox. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, being anxious as a kid and yet wanting to be, you know, on stage in the public eye?
I don't really understand it myself, but, you know, it's definitely true for me. When I was 13, 14, 15, 16, and then when I was 22, I had severe panic attacks. And, you know, when I was young, I didn't know what it was, and neither did my parents. I mean, it wasn't something that was common knowledge. And I learned later that, you know, panic attacks are, after the first time you have a panic attack, every subsequent panic attack comes from that fear of getting one again, you know. But in terms of why that would drive someone to perform, I have no idea.
Did you ever?
If you find out, tell me.
Did you ever have one on stage?
No. No, not really. I've been booed off stage and cried, you know.
What made you cry?
Just people screaming and, you know, all the worst. There's something called a prom show when you're in stand-up, where during prom season, kids, you do shows like at 1 a.m., 2 a.m., 4 a.m., you know, for these prom kids, and they're ruthless. Like, you know, all the worst parts of high school that, you know, so many stand-ups go through is revisited while you're standing on stage and they're saying, you know, next, and you suck, and, you know, like, the classic, it's always awful to hear in a crowd.
Well, I guess people are so intent on showing off for each other in the audience, and they're probably really drunk.
Yeah, and I probably sucked back then, who knows, but it's, you know.
You're one of those people who's managed to kind of create a career on your own terms, you know, by doing, like, stand-up and then doing your own very unusual movie and having your own really eccentric TV show. It's because it's not like other people were writing roles that would have suited you, or not that they were giving them to you?
Yeah, no. I've been really lucky. I mean, the ability to write and to generate and to kind of be the creator of what you do, you know, is such a benefit. You know, if I were just a straight actress, I'd be screwed, you know, because I've been in movies, and I'm pretty much am cast as the bitchy girlfriend before the guy finds out what love can be, or the the sassy or bitchy or what, or roommatey, like, as if that's not really an adjective, but you know, I had a realization, and after this last season of my show, and I don't know how long my show will last or if it's, you know, not long for this world or whatever, but this is what I love to do. I'd still like to be in a movie, sure, but I don't have that need anymore. I would much rather be in my show that I love or do stand-up than play the friend. I have no use for it anymore. It doesn't do anything for me spiritually or career wise or, you know, I got a script sent to me from one of my agents, and it said, you know, on the cover letter, like, so and so is set to play the role of Rebecca. Please look at the part of Suze. And I just laughed because I just thought, I don't want to be Suze anymore. I just have no desire to play Suze. You know what I mean? Like, the quintessential friend that is written in lieu of good writing. You know, it's the part is solely to be the exposition of the main girl character, you know? And I just, a good writer will write that in the actions and the dialogue of the main character. But to have a best friend part solely to be the exposition of the main character, it just doesn't do anything for me. It's killing my soul. I don't want to be Suze anymore.
How do the your sister is your co-star in the Sarah Silverman program, but yes. how does your extended family feel about it? Because your character is so inappropriate all the time. Are they on the wavelength to kind of get it, or do you have friends or family who are kind of embarrassed about the whole thing?
No, they love it, and they're completely supportive. And it's funny because I know I'm talking about this character I play like she's this completely different entity. And I know that she's probably I'm probably a lot more like her than I'd want to admit to myself. But I have to somehow, because it's funny. I don't know if I told you this last time I was here, but there's a book called Drama of the Gifted Child by Alice Walker, or Alice Miller, sorry. And I was reading this book that Laura had given me, my sister, and I'm like, this is unbelievable. You know, it's all about me, and you know, and I related to it so much. And I was talking about it to my other sister, Jodine, and her friend, Kathleen, and I said, oh, this book is amazing. Have you read Drama of the Gifted Child? And Kathleen said, oh, by Alice Miller. And I said, yes, yes. And she said, you know, it's a funny story that Alice Miller originally titled that book Drama of the Narcissistic Child. But she knew that no one who needed to read it would buy it.
That's really funny.
And yeah, that was very funny and a little bit embarrassing.
Sarah Silverman, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you. Oh, my gosh. Did we do it?
Yes.
Whew. That was fun.
Yes, it was. Sarah Silverman. The Sarah Silverman program starts its second season tonight on Comedy Central. Coming up, Tom Parker Bowles, the British food critic and son of Camilla Parker Bowles, talks about his year of eating dangerously. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Tom Parker Bowles, is a food critic for the British publications The Mail on Sunday and Tatler. He's also the son of Camilla Parker Bowles, Prince Charles's wife. He spent a year traveling the world in search of culinary extremes, ranging from ultra-hot hot sauce to revolting insects. His new book is called The Year of Eating Dangerously. Tom Parker Bowles, welcome to Fresh Air. What was the premise of your dangerous eating tour?
I think it was a chance, first of all, for me, you know, a greedy person, to travel around the world and eat, to find out all these different food cultures and look within those food cultures at the things that we see as more extreme, perhaps, but within that culture is not at all extreme in any way. So I just wanted to sort of be objective about strange foods. You know, one man's meat is another man's poison, as the cliche goes, but really to get in there, to strip away all those preconceptions of insects and dogs and the rest of it, and, you know, try and see it for what it actually is.
And as you point out in your book, all food is potentially dangerous.
Yeah. I mean, that was another premise, is that, you know, you could see civilization and the sort of the growth of man and the rest of it as, you know, a sort of battle against food, you know, fire, refrigeration, preservation. All these things are man's way of trying to control food that obviously rots and does become poisonous. So at the very basic level, all food is dangerous if it goes off. It sounds trite to say that, but, you know, this is a thing about all manner of danger in food rather than just, you know, weird, icky bugs and stuff.
Well, speaking of weird icky bugs, let's talk about some. One of the more revolting foods that you ate was silkworm poopie?
Poopie, exactly.
Explain what they are.
Well, they're obviously the unhatched silkworms before, so they look like a sort of a creature out of those alien movies. And the funny thing about it is that they're sold on the street of Korea as children's snacks. The children love them, eat them like candy. So I thought the children can eat them, you know, I can eat them. So I went to go and order them, and they look pretty repellent. And they're quite leathery to start with, and then actually they sort of burst like in your mouth, and this horrible sort of fetid taste comes out. But and it was really genuinely, in a whole year of eating all these sort of weird and wonderful foods, it was one of the only genuinely disgusting things I actually ate. You know, even stripping away the fact this was a bug, the taste for me was repellent. But again, like I say, for the children, it was entirely normal, like M&Ms or, you know, Snickers or something.
It was like a street food snack.
Of course, it was a street food, and they'd grown up with it. So growing up with something, they saw it as entirely normal. It was only me who was making the silly faces. And the, I mean, it's a taste of, as I say in the book, like sort of freshly dug graves. Now, this isn't something that I'd lick a lot, freshly dug graves, but it sort of brought to mind that sort of slight decay, that slight fetidness of the cemetery. It was pretty foul.
Not to gang up on Korea, where you had the silkworm poo pie, but also in Korea, you wanted to investigate dog as food. And I mean, this is something that you found very upsetting because you love dogs. But how much is dog part of Korean cuisine? From what I've been reading, it sounds like it's basically an illegal food. It's not regulated.
It's certainly not illegal. It's certainly very much legal. Occasionally, when the Olympics or the World Cup happens, the authorities sort of sweep it under the carpet for a bit, you know, to increase their world image or improve their world image, and then it comes back to normal again. And what my problem was, I didn't have a problem with dog fundamentally. Dog, you know, I love them, I've grown up with them, and I would never eat them as part of my diet. But I was annoyed by the way the West, and especially British tabloids, start screaming at cultures they don't understand, saying, oh, you barbarians, you eat dogs. Well, when we're quite happy to eat intensively farmed pigs and chickens that are brought up in horrible conditions just for cheap meat, you know, I think it's hypocritical to start talking about other cultures. Dog, of course, is more of a medicinal thing in Korea. It's not eaten every day by everyone. It's very expensive, and it's eaten mainly by men and mainly by sort of older men. It's supposed to make you virile and more potent, and it's an aphrodisiac. If you're going to strip everything away, a dog is the same as a cow, as the rest of it. But my problem with the dog was not so much that it was a dog, although I did have idiotic problems with that, but it was the way I found out they were raised. They were raised in the most horrible, inhumane conditions. The organic movement has not hit the dog farming world of Korea yet.
So what dog dish did you end up eating, and how did you feel about it while you were eating it?
The dish I had was called posintang, which is a traditional soup. And it's quite difficult for a Westerner to find dog in Korea, purely because it's not advertised. My Korean reading is obviously absolutely appalling. I can't read the characters. So, and I asked the hotel concierge, who weren't at all impressed, you know. And they were younger. The younger generation don't do it so much. They see it as barbaric and cruel and the rest of it. But in the end, I found something on the internet. Tiny little room off a main street, you know, the size of a sort of small kitchen. And the lady sort of met me wearing a pair of dog slippers, which I wasn't sure whether to take as a joke or something entirely serious. I ordered the soup, and it arrived, and it was, you know, it was absolutely fine. It was a big bowl of soup. There was, you know, a stock, lots of chilies, lots of garlic, and lots of sort of, the meat was quite grainy, a little bit gamey, but nothing too bad at all. I started eating it, thought, you know, this is easy. And then at a certain moment, the wind changed, or the air conditioning changed anyway, and this smell came, and it was like that smell of when you take your dogs out for a walk in the rain, you come back and they're wet or damp. It was like this kind of wet, damp dog, and I'm afraid to say that, you know, my sentimentality took over there. I took one more mouthful and legged it, I'm afraid.
My guest is Tom Parker Bowles, and his new book is called The Year of Eating Dangerously, and it's about traveling around the world for a year eating extreme food. The food that you ate in England was elvers, baby eels. What's extreme or dangerous about the baby eels?
Baby eels or elvers, the eel's the most fascinating creature. You know, it's born, no one's ever seen them reproduce or give birth somewhere in the Sargasso Sea, which is a sort of a weird sort of moving sea, you know, down by Bermuda. Anyway, they float across in the form of mycelium, which is some sort of a sort of leaf-like blob. They float for 2 years across the Atlantic until they hit brackish water by the coast, turn into tiny little wriggling matchsticks, baby eels, and swim up the coast, swim up rivers in Britain, especially the Severn. And in the old days, this used to be a huge local tradition. You know, elver fairs used to happen, and people used to come and catch all these lovely fish. They're delicious tasting, a local delicacy, very delicate with a good texture. But over the years, due to pollution and perhaps a touch of global warming and the filling in of their natural habitats, these elver numbers have gone down and down and down. And of course, there's huge demand for eel from China and Japan. So what's happened now is Elvering has become a very, very lucrative business. It's totally cash in hand, so therefore there's not too much tax. And if you imagine, you know, it's almost the sort of same price per gram as gold, these little things you have to catch, with cash bounties on their head and not taxmen and not a lot of law going on down there, it can be a pretty scary place to go. You certainly wouldn't go down there without the right people to the riverbank, you know, with a notepad as a reporter asking stupid questions. So there's this whole underworld behind this sort of slightly genteel veneer of southwest England. There's this sort of underworld. I mean, I hasten to say that 95% is totally legal and above board. It's just that there are a few of the more extreme members of society, I think, who come down looking to make a quick tax-free buck and are not happy if people start sniffing around, really.
So what's dangerous isn't the food. It's the kind of almost black market around the food.
Exactly. And again, like I say, there's not a black market around the food with the people who do it properly. The vast majority do it legally, pay their taxes, and are hardworking fishermen and the rest of it. It's just there is a slight sort of extreme who make it, you know, who do sometimes resort to violence to get people off their pitch.
So what's the taste of the baby eels like?
Well, it's very delicate, has a slight crunch, a very delicately fishy taste. The Spanish are absolutely mad for them. They call them anguillas, and they cook them with chili and garlic, sizzling in an earthenware pot. We traditionally in Britain used to cook them either, we used to fry bacon, take out the bacon, and then cook the elvers in the bacon fat and maybe break an egg in as well. So it was a great sort of breakfast dish. But they're very delicate, slightly fishy, sweet, a real, real delicacy, which, you know, sadly, the vast majority of Britain will never be able to eat again. You know, there used to be elver drink, you know, eating competitions and pints of elvers and all the rest of it. And now they're more expensive than caviar and foie gras. So they all get rushed off to China and Japan to be farmed into full-size eels.
Now, you came to America for, among other things, the hot sauce. Where does hot sauce fit into your idea of dangerous foods?
Well, this is the whole thing. I've always been a chili freak, a chili fanatic. And, you know, obviously when you're younger, you're, you know, look at this curry I'm eating. It's so hot, it's blowing my head off. Well, you know, yippee-yay. As you get older, you realise that the chili is one of the great fruits of the world. You know, the variety, the versatility, from the fruity heat of the habanero to the smoky warmth of the serrano. You know, all these different flavours and textures, and, you know, in different cuisines all over the world as well. But then again, I thought going to the National Fiery Food Show in Albuquerque, you know, I slightly got it wrong. I slightly thought it was going to be a whole lot of sort of hotheads tasting all these really hot sauces. And actually, it was a very, very highly efficient trade show with all the American chili world there. But I did manage to find some really stupidly hot extract sauces that no person in their right mind would eat. They're more for show. You know, if you think that Tabasco on the SKU, the Scoville heat scale is about 15,000, you're finding sauces here that are 15 million, you know, let's say 15 times hotter than pepper spray. So these are actually far too dangerous for me to try. But I did get a bit drunk a couple of times and sort of tried some of the milder ones that really, really hurt.
Is there anything that puts the flame out?
Well, it's certainly not water, because as they're oil-based, capsaicin, which is the sort of active ingredient, is water-based. So the best thing to do is a banana or rice or yogurt. The things to sort of smother it and get rid of it. Water just spreads it around the mouth. So definitely sort of a banana or rice or something like that.
My guest is British food critic Tom Parker Bowles. His new book is called The Year of Eating Dangerously. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Tom Parker Bowles, and he writes about food. His new book is called The Year of Eating Dangerously. What did you think of English food when you were growing up?
Well, there's this view in America, and I've been over backwards and forwards for years and years, and every time I speak to Americans, you know, from food lovers to food haters, they say, oh, gee, you know, English food, it must be so bad, so bland. And the problem is that a lot of Americans have tried our institutional food in the service stations, in the supermarkets, in the bad restaurants, and seen English food as dull and stodgy and you know, endless greasy puddings and chips, when actually, you know, great British food is, we've got some of the best produce in the world, and it's just very, very good things cooked simply. A steak cooked rare, just perfectly seasoned with really good chips. Fish and chips is masterful when the fish, you know, the oil's the right temperature, so the fish just steams inside that batter. You have a golden crispy batter and some moist thick flakes of fish within. It's not a highly spiced cuisine. It used to be 200 years ago, very highly spiced, but not so much now. But it's just about really simple seasonal ingredients. And I grew up thinking that British food was absolutely fantastic. You know, you'd be eating, your dad would catch a trout in the river, you'd eat it with potatoes dug up in the garden 20 minutes before with peas picked from the garden. It was all, I grew up in a world on a farm, so it was all seasonal, local, almost organic before these words became sort of buzzwords, you know, excuses to charge more money by the supermarkets. So I've always loved English food.
Prince Charles, who is now your stepfather, is into the slow food movement, and that's it's kind of like a regional food movement. The idea is, I'll let you describe the idea.
Well, what slow food was about is started by an absolutely visionary man called Carlo Petrini. What he was saying is, look, you know, this is the joy of eating and the production of food has all become sped up. It's all about making a fast buck. What he wanted to do is go back to artisanal making, and this is all over the world. There are now presidiums of the slow food movement. It's about food, you know. For example, look at the difference between an intensely farmed chicken that takes only a few weeks to go from chick to slaughter, and it's pumped artificially with all sorts of hormones and sort of antibiotics and the rest of it, and it's just a product. Whereas he's going back saying, why not choose an old-fashioned breed that is made for the area, that grows slowly, but yet has the most fantastic meat? Or the same with a pig. Why not use a Gloucester Old Spot or a Lop or a Tamworth, which are British native pigs? They do take longer. They do take more time and money to produce, but at the end of it, the animal's happier and the person eating at the end is happier. So it's about food being produced, not fast produced food and mass produced food, but slowly produced food like it used to be done. And also he talks about the joys of the table, you know, the joy of a Saturday sitting with friends having a 6-hour lunch. You don't have to be drunk all the way through it. It's about sitting down and letting, you know, really just taking a break from this sort of really, really fast the fast pace of the modern world. And it's a fantastic movement. It's trying to negate all this, you know, this new movement of mass industrialization and cares more about taste than a quick profit.
Is this now something that you and Prince Charles have in common that you can share?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, he's a man who, you know, 10, 15 years ago, he was talking about the advantages of organic farming, of sustainable farming, of buying locally, of buying seasonally. And of course, you know, at the time, everyone was saying he was mad. Now, of course, he's been totally, you know, justified in what he said. He was absolutely spot on and way, way ahead of his time. He knows a huge amount about farming, about the way food is produced, and he cares, you know, very, very deeply about the British farmer and actually about the, you know, the state of the environment across the world. So people might sit and criticise him, but I wouldn't hear a word against him, at all.
If you don't mind my asking, and if you do mind, just tell me, how did it change your life when the tabloids picked up, or Andrew Morton in his book picked up that your mother and Prince Charles were having an affair, and then, you know, boom, spotlight on your family?
Sure. I mean, people often say, you know, it must have been hard and seeing your mother and being attacked and abused and all the rest of it. But my sister and I have, you know, we've always been pragmatic about it. We've had the most privilege it's possible for any children to have. We've had an entirely idyllic childhood. And, you know, sometimes you wish you could have some horror story saying how awful it was. But my parents, to both of us, were perfect parents. So by the time we were 18, 17, 18, this happened. Sure, there were days when people were a bit rude and the rest of it. But, you know, we could have been, you know, this isn't difficult. We could have been born in a slum. We could have been abused. We could have been born in a war zone. We could have been born with no parents. So putting everything into context, nothing was difficult and nothing really changed at all. You just shrug it off and get on with it. My parents have always been very good to both of us and they're still friends. That's all that mattered to me, my parents being happy and I suppose selfishly us being happy as well. You know, people say we're affected by this. No, we had a very secure family and good friends, so that kept us going through it.
Prince Charles is in line to become king. If your mother becomes queen, like, how would that affect your life?
I don't think it'd be any different from my life now, actually. We might see her a little less, but it wouldn't. You know, my sister and I were married. I've got a child coming in a week, touch wood. My sister's pregnant. We have our own lives, you know. We don't live around our mother. Of course, it's a pleasure to go and see her and my stepfather, as it is to go and see my father and my stepmother. But we have our own lives now, so it doesn't make much difference to our life at all.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Tom Parker Bowles is the author of the new memoir, The Year of Eating Dangerously. You can download podcasts of our show by going to our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Cabot Creamery, one of several socially active food cooperatives. Details are at go.coop. That's go.coop. And from Anne and John Herman, celebrating the Breakthrough Collaborative, involving middle school students in learning and older students in teaching at breakthroughcollaborative.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, how the Founding Fathers came up with the separation of church and state, a stunning innovation for its time, and how it's been challenged during different historical periods by evangelicals. We talk with Gary Wills about his new book, Head and Heart, American Christianities. Join us for the next Fresh Air. on the next Fresh Air. How the found again in 3, 2, 1.